So I'll begin by talking about a not-so-recent subject, namely that of tree-level recursion relations in Young-Mills theories, which also go by the name of BCFW relations. This stands for Brito, Cacciazzo, Feng, and Witten. And the reason I want to talk about this first is that this will set the stage for the more recent results I want to present, namely about onshore recursion relations for one-loop amplitude in Young-Mills theories. And I'll be talking about a certain class of one-loop amplitudes. You see, I haven't listed here everything. The pluses and minuses in my talk will denote helicities. So I'm talking about Young-Mills amplitudes in four space-time dimensions, two physical degrees of freedom, positive and negative helicities. That's the meaning of those pluses and minuses. Now, these amplitudes at one loop are very special because they're rational functions. They're rational functions because they vanish at the tree level. So this is where I will be moving towards, and some of this stuff is review. The reason for being interested in such a topic, well, we already heard two nice talks by Nimar Kanihamed and Zibern, who motivated this subject thoroughly, so I don't feel like I need to add anything to what they had to say. But let me try to summarize in few words why you should think of applying these onshore recursion relations, as opposed to, you know, you have a Lagrangian, why not just compute straightforward Feynman diagrams, sum them all together, and that's going to be my physical amplitude. Well, the problem with this Feynman diagrammatic-based approach is that it's the least efficient way of computing the amplitude. For one thing, in gauge theories, the number of terms that you're supposed to sum to arrive at the physical amplitude increases factorially with each external leg that you're adding. And second, the physical amplitude is gauge invariant. And as a result, it has, more often than not, a very nice, simple, compact, elegant expression. You can see some structure there. Whereas the individual Feynman diagrams that lead to it, they're obviously not gauge invariant. And sometimes, again, more often than not, the answer for a single Feynman diagram stretches over pages and pages and pages. All those terms that you have there in one individual Feynman diagrams will cancel against many other terms from other Feynman diagrams, and then you arrive at the answer, which is very simple. So the simplicity of the final answer, the simplicity of the onshore amplitude, is not visible in the individual Feynman diagrams. So all of this makes the search for alternative methods for computing the Young-Mills amplitudes a worthwhile enterprise. It's, you know, it's a valid effort. It's time well spent. One such alternative method to the Feynman diagrammatic expansion is through these onshore recursion relations. What it means that if you have an endpoint amplitude, you can reconstruct it from the previously computed amplitudes with fewer external legs. So instead of starting from scratch, as you would if you were to use Feynman diagrammatic approach each time, what you can do is to recycle what you have already computed. So in this sense, it's quite efficient. The next topic I want to address in this talk is the use of the space-cone gauge. Now, when I talk about it, people refer to it as the funny gauge. Well, you'll see what they mean by that. And all I can say is that the space-cone gauge is the ideal setting for studying the onshore recursion relations. The reason for that is you're going to see in a few moments the BCFW recursion proof relies on a certain analytic continuation of the amplitude. The recursion itself is based on the property, at least at the tree level, that the analytically continued amplitude vanishes as a function of z when z goes to infinity. Now, this is a very non-trivial statement because we're talking about a gauge theory. The vertices that we have, the interaction vertices, have derivative couplings. So whatever analytic continuation you're going to implement through a shift of the external momenta will propagate in each vertex. And you're going to get positive powers of z in the numerator from the vertices. The suppression will come from the propagators. So the fact that the analytically continued amplitude vanishes as z goes to infinity is a non-trivial statement. And it's true only for certain analytic continuations. Now, what the space-cone gauge will do for you, again, the goal is not to regress to computing Feynman diagrams, but the space congage Lagrangian will tell you which sort of analytic continuations are harmless, which analytic continuations will not leave an imprint on the vertices. And if, in addition to that, the analytic continuation you're using doesn't leave an imprint on the external line factors on the polarization tensors, then you're safe, because you're going to just get the benefit of the suppression coming from the propagators. So that's why I want to talk about the space congage. And then there are some old results that I found together with Ed Yao in December of 2005. Namely, we showed, using the space congage Lagrangian, we showed how the Feynman diagrams reassemble themselves to give you the BCFW on-shell recursion. And if you're not satisfied with this, you're going to see that everything relies on a very, very simple, silly almost, identity, which is partial fractioning. So if you're not satisfied with this very simple answer and you search for a deeper meaning, namely, why do we do these analytic continuations? What is their origin? Where do they come from? Well, I think that the answer is something coming from an identity which is due to Veltman. It dates back to 1963, and it's called the largest time equation. What it means that if you have a causal theory and you're given a sequence of space-time points, you can time order them. And just from this fact, you can extract all sorts of identities. One of them is the optical theorem Katkowski rules. But then there is something else which selects two vertices, two space-time points, treats them differently from the others, and there are going to be some step functions in this identity. And those step functions, when you represent them in an integral form, will actually induce the shift of the external momenta. Okay. So then I'm going to talk about other analytic continuations that you might use. So there is the BCFW analytic continuation, which uses a shift of two external gluon momenta. But there are others. And in fact, these others are the ones that are useful for the on-shell recursion relation that we found for one-loop amplitudes. So again, we're going to search for what are the possible analytic continuations such that the analytically continued amplitude goes to zero when z goes to infinity as a function of z on the complex plane. And the space congage will tell me what are the acceptable analytic continuations. And the discussion at the one-loop level, and I'll conclude. Okay. Can we turn on the lights a little bit?
The front ones,
yes. Oh, thank you. Okay, so this is the three-level on-shell recursion relation of Brito, Cacciato, Feng, and Witten, written as an equation. Now, here is what I tried to do and sketch it pictorially. So what do we have on the left-hand side? On the left-hand side, we have a three-level amplitude, which is determined by specifying the moment of the external legs. So here I have an endpoint, p, q, p1, pn minus 2. Actually, that should have, yeah. Right. So it's an endpoint. And you have also to specify helicities of your external legs. And this defines, actually, the left-hand side of that equation. Now, this endpoint can be written as a sum over on-shell amplitudes, product of on-shell amplitudes, also three-level, multiplied by a propagator. Now, the first thing that you realize is that what has happened here on the right-hand side, this internal line K is placed on shell. K cannot be on shell at the three level if the external momenta remain as they are. So in order to place an internal line on shell at the three level and still preserve the energy momentum conservation, you have to do something with the external momenta. The simplest case scenario, pick two of them. I gave them special names, P and Q. And I've drawn them adjacent, but you don't have to. It was just for simplicity. So again, to preserve the energy momentum conservation, the shift in P has to be opposite to the shift in Q. In order to solve the condition that this internal line K has been placed on shell, this is what on-shell recursion means. All external legs now, including the one which would have been an internal line, are on the mass shell. So K now is null. So in order to preserve the condition that the shift in momenta P, Q, are also on the mass shell, so they remain null. Eta, and do so with just a single parameter, then the vector eta, the four vector eta, has to be null. The condition that p hat remains on the mass shell tells you that eta is transverse to p, and the condition that q hat is on the mass shell, eta is transverse to q. So a corollary is that eta has to be complex. Okay, so this is BCFW recursion relation.
Eta is not orthogonal to pi and qi?
No. It doesn't have to be. Those other momenta remain as they are. They're not shifted.
But then the invariants, p dot pi, and the various invariants on which the amplitude depends on the left-hand side
will change naturally, yes.
Change.
Yes.
So how does that work? Because the amplitude on the left-hand side...
I'm going to show that.
Amplitude on the left-hand side has poles.
Yes.
For specific values of pi.
That's right.
Pi.
Well, in this case, the poles are going to be poles in z. So what
I understand, but...
That's right. So there will be poles which come from the scalar product, the kinematic invariants of p hat with the pi's. But that tells you specifically which internal line you're cutting.
So it doesn't, when I look at this regular relation, there are extra poles in z as well. You just exhibited some of them.
The z's that are on the right-hand side are fixed. They're determined by, you see, you start spreading these external lines on the left and right on-shell factors. And you sum over all possible ways of spreading these external lines in the left, distributing them in the left and the right amplitude, such that the cyclic ordering is preserved. So the cyclic ordering of the external blues, there is a color trace that I'm pulling outside, which tells me that the external blues have to be cyclic ordered. The cyclic order is preserved both on the left and on the right. And what I'm doing, I'm distributing the external legs between the left and right amplitude. And what it tells you, it tells you that you see, say that you have some...
I'm just confused as to where, if I look at this, z is something that flows through the diagram.
Right. So what you're doing, you're taking, this is p,
yeah,
which becomes p of z. This is q, which becomes q of z.
Right.
And through the z shift, what you're going to do is to localize the amplitude onto the kinematical poles. And that means that you're going to snap each internal line that belongs to the unique path at the tree level, which joins P and Q. Mm-hmm. And you're going to put one of these guys on shell at a time. So for each particular factorization, you're going to determine the value of Z.
Mm-hmm.
So
but
Z is,
the residues of those poles themselves can have poles.
I'm going to come to that.
Well, I'm just asking.
At the tree level, there are not double poles. I'm going to show that.
If Z is flowing through that graph,
yes,
there are two propagators which it flows through.
Right.
Why aren't there double poles?
But they're simple poles. Each of them is a simple pole.
So it's a product.
Yes, it's a product. So you're supposed to sum over all those residues.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So this is one particular term, and then you have another particular term where you're cutting this internal
right.
line. And you're supposed to sum over all such things. And that's tantamount to summing over all possible ways to distribute these external lines among the left and right amplitude.
This doesn't seem to require the external lines to be massless.
Yeah, it does.
Where
are massless?
The external lines are massless.
They're on shell, but
the shifted ones remain massless, which tells you that eta is transverse to p.
It's not clear why this trick would work for massive fields.
It won't work for massive fields. Not with a single z, because then you're supposed to solve the mass shell condition.
But as long as
p-squared
won't change. So if massive stays massive, that's enough.
Say that again. If
p squared is m squared, p hat squared is m.
That's right.
So you stay on the shell, my hat.
Well, in my case, these are gluons. They're massless.
Okay, but you, I know it's...
This trick also works for massive external particles.
That was the question.
No.
Doesn't?
No. With massive legs, then you can't do this. You can't preserve the condition that P and Q are both on the mass shell with a single Z parameter. You need more. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. You should go on. I need it.
Even with complex momenta, you can't?
No. Well, it's a little bit of a...
Oh, well. Light-like and orthogonal to a timeline.
But it's complex, so it has a lot of... Anyway, go on. Please go on. Yeah, this is not 45.
I believe I did the algebra. It just doesn't work. You can't put both P and Q and preserve them, the shifted ones, with a single Z on the mass shell, unless both P and Q are null. Okay, so this is the story that Brito, Cacciozzo, Feng, and Witten had to say in January of 2005. And what we did almost 11 months later is to show that you can use the cutting rules, basically the prescription on how to place these lines on shell, which follow from the largest time equation and from the use of the space cone gauge. And we showed how the Feynman diagrams reassemble themselves in the BCFW recurrence relation, and that's what we did then.
Are you going to go through that?
Yes, because I tried to give you the complete story. And I presume that not many people, I think just one, are familiar with that. Okay, so the significance of the onshore recurrence relation, just to say this once again so that everybody knows why this is worthwhile, is that you're going to be able to recycle what you have previously computed to generate the higher endpoint function. Now, I'm going to apologize for this slide. There is little to no physics in it, and people who hate indices will think that this is an abomination, but this is the Spinor-Halesti formalism information that I need to tell you to be able to continue the discussion in four space-time dimensions. Okay, so if you have a four-component Lorentz vector, V mu, you can repackage it as a bispinor, as a 2x2 matrix, by dotting it with the sigma mu A dot Pauli matrices and the identity matrix. On the major diagonal, you have the light cone components. On the minor diagonal, you have these so-called space cone components. So what are they? Well, my conventions will be that lowercase letters will denote components, and capital letters will denote the four momenta, the four vectors. So this lowercase v is this complex combination of two space-like components of the four vector v, and v bar is its complex conjugate. Okay, the inner product of two vectors can be represented in this form, where the indices here have been lowered with the epsilon Levi-Civita tensor to components. The norm of a four vector is given just by inspection by the determinant of that matrix. So now if your vector V is null, then the determinant of this 2x2 matrix vanishes, your matrix is reducible. And here is the basic principle of twistors, namely a null vector, one whose determinant of this bispinor matrix vanishes, can be written as the square of a commuting spinor, also referred to as twistor. So this is here. The VAs are positive chirality to component commuting spinors. The VA dots are the negative chirality to component spinors. You can define twistor products on the spaces of the VAs and VA dots. The angular product is a product on the space of positive chirality twisters. Again, the contraction here is done with the two-component epsilon Levi-Civita tensor, so that tells you that the product of V itself vanishes. On the space of negative chirality twisters, you can define similarly another product, again, antisymmetric in V and U, and you can write the inner product of two vectors as a product of twisters. Okay, this is the BCFW proof. Very elegant, no need for indices, except that, again, I'm going to abuse your patience and write something very explicit here. So the whole point is you have your physical amplitude, and you give a prescription on how to analytically continue it in the complex plane by shifting two external momenta, P and Q, such that they remain on shell. And as you can see here, I've already used twister notation. So any vector, four vector, that can be written as a product of twisters is on shell. So that tells you that P hat is on shell, Q hat is on shell. And eta, the complex vector which was transverse to both P and Q, can be written like so. Is it clear that eta is transverse to P, obviously? Right, because P is the product of these two guys. And then when you take the scalar product of the four momentum P with eta, then you end up taking the product of these two twisters, which is zero. Okay, so this is the prescription. And then what did Brito, Cacciozzo, Feng, and Witten do was to evaluate this contour integral, dz over z of a of z. Wonderful. So we're going to do this using Cauchy's residue theorem. And provided that the amplitude A of z goes to 0 with this contour taken at infinity, then the integral vanishes. On the other hand, you can say the integral localizes onto its poles. At the tree level, they're just simple poles. The first one is at z equal 0. That has nothing to do with the poles of A of z. It's just whatever I have here in the integrand. But this is our original amplitude, right? If you put here z equals 0, you go back to the original amplitude. And then the rest of the terms come from the residues of A of z. And the factor that you have here in the denominator, zk, comes from z evaluated at those poles. And now each of these poles, each of these residues, correspond to internal lines which are placed on shell. And that's all there is to it. Very nice.
Some qualifications so that you exclude some subset of invariants vanishing.
No.
Add poles. I mean, otherwise you can get double
poles. I'm going to show that.
You get double poles.
Not at the tree level. I get product of poles. All of them are simple.
You eliminated quartic vertices?
Yes.
Oh, you didn't say that.
Well, I'm going. Well, they didn't say that. This is what they said. I mean, they said, look, there are only simple poles at the tree level. Now, if you're Witten, you see that in a second. If you're like I am, then you need to see those.
Unless you have subsets of momenta that can vanish.
Yeah. So anyway, I understand.
Opposite momenta, right. Then you'll have double poles.
Right, I know. But, you know, that's not anywhere, at least, that I know of in his paper. So somehow they found... Okay, so, you know, hindsight is 20/20. Those guys did it first, and then, you know, I had to resort to the space comb gauge to show precisely that the quartic vertices are absent, and I'm going to show that completely. Okay, so the upshot of looking at the gauge and going back to a Lagrangian is not to compute Feynman diagrams. What we want to do is to look at the Feynman rules and the Feynman diagrams to select which analytic continuations are good. The good ones are the ones that are not going to propagate through the vertices. The good ones are the ones which are not going to change the external polarizations. Anything else will spoil the property that A goes to 0 as Z goes to infinity, as we close that contour at infinity. Okay, so the space comb gauge was introduced by Chalmers and Ziegel in 98, who are trying to answer the question, what is the simplest algebra of Feynman diagrams that you can have for Young-Mills theories? And they looked at spinor helicity formalism, and they noticed that... Oops. Okay. Come on, go back. Now, this is what happens when you don't think ahead. That wasn't even my email, it was my husband's. This is bad. Usually, if I hit backspace, I go back, but I cannot go back, I can only go forward.
PowerPoint, can you start again?
No. Okay, setting notation. We talked about this. PCFW, full space page. Okay. Window. Full screen. Okay. Not the best way to proceed, but anyway. So Chalmers and Ziegel noticed that in the spinor helicity formalism, the most efficient algebra is done by choosing all the positive helicity gluons in one sort of Lycon gauge and all the negative helicity external gluons, their gauge fixed in a different Lycon gauge. And they say, why don't we just cram these two Lycon gauges together? And they came up with something like this. Okay, so eta is one of these complex null vectors. It's not real. It's not Lycon. Mm-hmm. Lycon eta would have been real, and in twister rotation they've been plus plus. In Lycon gauge, what you do, you gauge away A plus to be 0, a Lycon component. In space comb gauge, what you gauge to 0, what you gauge away is one of these space complex space-like components. That's A1 plus IA2. So that's all there is to it. And then for A bar, you're going to see that it's equation of motion. It's independent of the debar derivative, just like in Lycon gauge, the equation of motion for A minus was independent of the plus derivatives. And then to get the full benefit of a physical gauge, you just eliminate A bar via its equation of motion. You plug it back in the Lagrangian. And here you just have the physical degrees of freedom, the positive and negative helicity fields. So A plus corresponds to a positive helicity gluon, A minus to a negative helicity one. And the vertices are just like in Lycon, non-local, except that instead of 1 over the pluses, you have 1 over d's, which is 1 over, it's d1 minus i d2, basically, partial derivative. And that's the space gauge fixed Lagrangian. Now, right now, it doesn't seem too promising and not that different from Lycon gauge. But to get the full benefit from the space gauge, you're supposed to do the following. You take one negative helicity gluon, momentum p, and you define these plus elements of the twistor base. I need 4 elements in the twistor base. You take another momentum of a gluon that has positive helicity, and you define the minus elements of the twistor base. And you take eta, your gauge fixing vector, to be plus minus. This is very important because, I mean, whatever choices I've made here seem to not matter much there, perhaps the vertices. But the helicity, the fact that I've chosen P to come from a negative helicity gluon and Q from a positive helicity gluon, these statements are not transparent right now. That's because the Lagrangian that I have over here is the Lagrangian of an effectively complex scalar. However, we're talking about scattering amplitudes of spin, massless spin 1 particle, which means that you're supposed to dress the external legs with wave functions, with polarization tensors. And the polarization vectors for the two independent ones, and you see these are vectors because I've written them as products of twistors, have to be transverse to the momenta. So that's basically the form they can take, given the choice that I've made. And then if you look at the external line factors, then you're going to see that to make sense of the space gauge and not to get undefined 1 over 0, then you're supposed to select the pluses and minus elements of the twistor base and the gauge fixing vector according to this prescription. Suppose that you switch this and you make it a positive helicity gluon and this one a negative helicity gluon, then you have to switch eta. So that's the correlation of the gauge fixing vector with the external line factors. Okay, so told you this story. And now let me give one punchline, which is the answer to the question, where is the quartic vertex going if we're going to make this Z shift? For the reference gluons, the external line factors vanish. Why? Because Q is this minus minus product. Let's look, Q is positive helicity. So you have a zero in the numerator. Similarly, for the negative helicity gluon with momentum p, p is plus, so you have a zero in the numerator. So what does it mean, that everything goes to zero? Obviously not. There are similar factors that you're going to find only in a certain set of vertices, and a precisely identical zero that you get from these vertices in the denominator. And that tells you that the reference gluons, the ones you've used to define the space gauge, participate only in a specific set of vertices. The positive ones only in plus, plus, minus, the negative ones in minus, minus, plus. And then, as you probably guessed, these reference gluons that we've used to define the space gauge are the same ones we're going to use to shift to write the onshore recursion relations.
So there can be 4-point gluons.
Not the reference ones.
Can be 4-point vertices.
Yes, not the reference ones. Exactly. Because the ones that I'm shifting are the ones that I've used to define the space gauge.
I still don't see why you couldn't get double poles, though. Because
does it matter if you have double poles?
What?
Why does it matter if you have double poles?
Oh, it matters.
I use the formula.
No, the
formula. Absolutely.
I mean, why not something like Z plus the maybe it's not, doesn't it, matter.
It,
it's a measure zero.
It just, I cannot put this line on shell with Z shift.
Why?
Because Z doesn't flow through here.
Oh, Z doesn't flow through here. That's just the tadpole.
Yeah.
Okay, right. No, no, no. But no, but still, there would be double tadpole. Yeah.
Sorry, since the derivation used Cauchy's theorem, why isn't the answer just that double poles don't contribute to the quotient?
Well, in fact, you can see why it's nasty, because that actually is infinity. So they do contribute. They're really two similar.
Look,
I mean, that's special points.
I disagree with that, because the graph that you drew is part of the ones that I'm going to discuss anyway. And all you have here is, yes, there is a pole here, and there is a pole here, but you see the momentum that you get through this part of the graph, because you have external lines here.
Yeah,
it's different.
The external lines don't add up to zero, that's fine.
Right. If the external lines don't add up to zero, I'm fine. Right. Okay, so as promised, in the space con gauge, if you make the Z shifts on the reference gluons, where the eta that you've used in the onshore recurrence relation is the same one as the one that you've used to define the space con gauge, then what happens is that the only components which change for these shifted momenta are the bar components. The bar components are the ones which don't appear, and I probably cannot go back. I don't know, it never happened to me before. This is just a PDF file. Okay, so the bar components are the ones which don't appear in these derivative couplings. The bar components would come with the bar derivatives, but these are absent. So any momentum shift that is going to be of this type, P1 minus IP2, it's just not going to be felt through the vertices. Obviously, you're going to feel it in the propagators, but not in the vertices.
Say it again.
So the danger with these shifts is that the vertices will acquire Z dependence. The statement I'm making is that the momentum obviously changes with Z, but the derivative couplings don't depend on this combination of the momentum components, on the bar components. So this is the summary. The vertices are insensitive. The propagators acquire a Z dependence. That means that you have enough Z suppression to kill the Z to infinity. There are only simple poles, multiple poles, but they're distinct at the tree level. They're simple on the internal lines which connect the shifted gluon lines P and Q. And this is what ensures the factorization of the tree level amplitudes. Obviously, I glossed over one very, very important fact. It's not sufficient that the vertices are insensitive to the shift, but the polarizations have to be insensitive to the shift as well. So as you see, these polarization vectors will change with the momentum. But the shifts are such that they're not going to change. So this is a four-point in space con gauge. It's just one diagram, very simple to compute. And this is the statement of BCFW recursion. The single diagram, which is my amplitude in the space con gauge, there is nothing else besides this, can be written as the product of two on-shell amplitudes, but these are on-shell with complex momenta, obviously with real momenta, 3-point would vanish, multiplied by the propagator of the line which has been placed on-shell. But there is no distinction between left and right. The vertices are the same, the propagator is the same, and there is an external line factor for this guy, an external line factor for that guy, but their product for the same momentum and opposite helicities is one. So this is BCFW trivially for 4-point in space con gauge. Now 5-point. Okay, I picked something because, you know, I wanted to give an example. You don't have to do this. You can take your pick anything. The blue lines are the reference gluons, the ones with respect to which I've defined my space con gauge. So the vertices depend on what I called reference gluons 1 and 5. And BCFW recursion tells me, okay, so once again, no changing the vertices. So all I have to do now is to look at the Feynman diagram and realize that if I change P1 and P5 as a function of z and I'm looking for poles, the poles will come from the K propagator and the L propagator. They're simple poles. So I have two terms, one with the z shift that determines this P1 hat and P5 hat such that this guy is now on shell, and another z shift with the double hats here such that this guy is now on shell. And since, again, the vertices are the same on the left and right, you can just factor them out and think of this as an identity for propagators. There are three Feynman diagrams that build this three-level amplitude with the choice of helicities that I've given there. The other two have 1 and 5 separated by a single internal line. There is no distinction between left and right. Now, if you add A and C, you're going to get one of the terms in the BCFW where you factor this 5-point into a product of a 3-point and a 4-point. This is the 3-point, and if you add these two guys, you see there is the same propagator factor. If you add these two guys, then you get one of these on-shell amplitudes, in this case a 4-point. And likewise, if you add B and D, you're going to factor into a 3-point, which has K, 4, 5, and a 4-point, again, you have to add these two guys together to arrive at the on-shell amplitude. Okay, so we're left with an identity between propagators. And if you play with it, in terms of these specific Z shifts, which put those two internal lines on shell, it's just partial fractioning. So this is how BCFW works concretely. This is how I promise that I'm going to show how the Feynman diagrams reassemble themselves.
What is Z hat?
Yeah, the double hat is the guy which put on shell the P4-5. And Z hat, I could have chosen a better notation. Yeah, I know. Okay, and then this is something which I thought I should tell you, because you can write on shell recursion relations if you have minimally coupled scalars as well. The point is that you don't shift the moment of the scalars. You don't try to factorize the amplitude with respect to the scalars. But if you have an amplitude where, you know, you have, and the scalars could be massive, doesn't matter. So as long as you factorize this amplitude with respect to some null momenta that you have, so if your external lines, if your partons, if among them you find gluons, massless spin one particle, then you can shift the momentum of those gluons. Again, you go to the space Phong gauge and everything works. And the internal propagators, they don't have to be massless after you put them on shell. And everything, again, is just partial fractioning. Each one of those propagators, one at a time, is placed on shell. You express those momenta through the specific Zs, and that's what the Z1, Z2, Zn minus 1. In this case, you had n minus 1 internal lines that you could place on shell. It's just, you know, fun with algebra. Nothing really deep here. Now, this is where the deeper meaning behind these shifts would come from. And as I said, it looks like when you're making these Z shifts, what you're doing is to think that you have a causal theory and you have established some light-like ordering among the sequence of space-time points. So let's take just the simplest example for this largest time equation of Veltman that I can think of, namely for a two-point. The two-point is a propagator, Feynman propagator, and you can write it as a sum depending whether the time at the space-time point x is greater than y. You can have a term where here you have a mass shell projection onto positive frequencies, plane waves, that's delta plus. And if the opposite is true, namely that the time at the position space-time point y is greater than the one at x, then you have another mass shell projection of plane waves with negative frequencies in delta minus. So this is an example of the largest time for a two-point. Now imagine that instead of doing a time ordering, you do a time-like, you do a Lycon time ordering. So these times are Lipkin times. And suppose now that for the next step, what you're doing, you take these step functions, which order your space-time points, and you write them in an integral parametrization as dz over z minus I epsilon for these guys, for instance, time exponent I minus z eta dotted into x minus y, where eta is light-like. Okay? So that ensures that I have this projection here, and the rest is just a rewriting of the step function. But now you see what has happened. The momentum that was flowing through this internal line got shifted by z eta. So now if you imagine that you did this like ordering using a vector eta, which is real, and the next step what you're doing is to complexify eta, then what you're going to do is to have precisely the z eta shifts that one implements with BCFW. Okay, that was just the simplest baby example that I can think of this largest time equation. And Volkmann in 63, he came up with the following set of rules which lead to a set of trivial algebraic identities. They're just, you know, true. So basically, if you have n vertices, you take your Feynman diagram. Oh my gosh. How much time do I have? Okay, sorry. I spent too much time on this. If you have a Feynman diagram with n vertices, what you do, you duplicate that Feynman diagram 2 to the n times. Why that? Because each vertex, now we're going to define that it can be either circle or uncircled. A Feynman diagram where all the vertices are uncircled is our original Feynman diagram. A Feynman diagram where all the vertices are circled is the complex conjugate one. So through these circlings, what we do is to just complexify a vertex. But then there is more to it. The propagator between uncircled vertices is our original one. Between circled vertices, the complex conjugate one. That was trivially following from what I said before. But then here is a new set of rules. The propagator between circled and uncircled vertices is one of these mass shell positive frequency projections, delta plus. And then there is delta minus. And if you add all of these guys together, then what you get is zero. And the reason is very simple, because if you can establish an ordering among a sequence of space-time points, one of them is always going to have the largest time. So if one of them has always the largest time, let me isolate it. So here is anything, and this is our largest time. But we have also the diagram where here I have anything and that vertex which is circled. Because this time is the largest, that means that all these propagators secretly are delta pluses. A circle around this vertex brings a minus sign, so when you add them all together, you get zero. And this is nothing but the optical theorem. This is how you get Tarkovsky rules. It's cute. But then this is not what we want. We want something where we have these step functions. And since you have these identities, you know, you can play around, you can reshuffle the terms. And here is one particular identity where you select two space-time points. And these are the guys where we're going to have our shifted momenta. So in this case, K and L. And you treat them differently from the rest. For instance, here, this term, this is our original Feynman amplitude. This is the one where all the diagrams where the special vertices, the ones which get treated differently, don't have circles around them. If they don't have circles, that means that sometimes you get to snap, you get to cut an internal line because of those delta pluses and delta minuses. Here's a sub-function. And this term, this f, is an amplitude where a k is not circled, but L is circled, and then you have anything else. And so basically, this is it. So now, for instance.
So it's a lot easier in space-time than it is in momentum space.
Yes, in momentum space, it's a lot easier. You just get even.
But I mean in position space, it's easier.
Well, you can Fourier transform this. That's the whole point.
No, I understand.
And when you Fourier transform them and you use this integral representation of the step function, you get the z shift. And then we went backwards. So we un. Okay, so you go from momentum space to position space. This is our identity with the propagators, you know, for the 5 point, where. Here you had the two propagators say that was the 5 point. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? And then we had an identity where this thing, we wrote it as so 1 hat, 5 hat. So I shifted T1 and T5 such that to put this internal line on shell, that was one term. And then there was another one where we've cut that line. So this is 3 here, 1, 2, and the double hats, which David hated, 1 over P4, 5 square, 4, and 5 double hat. Okay, so this was our identity of the propagators. 1 over P1, 2 square, 1 over P1, P4, 5 square equals 1 over whatever it is, P1, 2 square. But here you see you have the shifted propagator. So this is P4, 5 hat square. So it's this propagator identity. You go back to position space because you want to compare this with the largest time. Okay, so that's just the propagator in position space. Now these are the guys which have the shifted momentum, and you see the delta pluses and the step functions appear. And then you just compare. You compare the largest time equation for that 5 point that I had there, where you've declared special x1 and x3, so you write that largest time equation that I had before. For the vertices, this was, say, x1 and that's x3. And this is what you get. You compare with what you had from the propagator identity, Fourier transform back to position space. And it's almost a perfect match, except for these terms. Now, it turns out that they have measure zero, these distributions. The reason is that you have here two on-shell, two mesh-shell conditions, and a single eta, z-eta shift. So you cannot satisfy them both, probably. Okay. So that's the story. And for the largest time, as I said before, eta has to be real. Otherwise, I don't know what's the meaning of those integrals and step functions. But then you can think of analytically complexifying later on. Okay, so other possible analytic continuations.
So one second. So the secret of this is the choice of gauge, so you only get cubic vertices. That was essential. So for phi cubed, this would have worked.
It won't.
What?
For phi cubed, it will, but.
It's automatic. And for gauge theories in the specific gauge.
For gauge theories, it should work in any gauge, but you see here in this.
But here you can take advantage of.
Right, and you just stare at the Lagrangian and diagrams that you have.
And it's essentially this is just this largest time equation.
I think so. Yeah, that's what happens with the zeta shift. But you know, you don't have to think that far back. I mean, you can take it at face value and just you know, possibilities are endless. What can I do with it? And that's what Bernd, Dixon, and Kosover did in 05. So possibilities were endless. Witten and friends show that you can just do this double momentum shift and analytically continue the amplitude, and let's evaluate contour integrals. Okay, but then subtle things happen at the loop.
Sounds to me like you're saying that the BCFW prescription is easier to understand in position space.
I'm not making that statement. I'm just saying that if I have to find an interpretation for it, yes, if I have to find an interpretation for it, yes.
Oh, or a proof.
Yeah.
But doesn't that suggest, I mean, does that suggest that it might be easier to try to think of ways of reconstructing amplitude in position space rather than in momentum space?
It's all equivalent, right?
I know it's equivalent.
And it's just that in position space I had a few terms that I had to throw away after, you know, some inspection.
Well, those indeed were, I think, these special cases.
Right.
I had the same feeling. This is Coleman-Norton theorem. That says that all of the singularities are from on-shell. Classical.
Right, but you have to allow the possibility of having a complex momentum because,
extreme.
You know, that this 3 point, for instance,
yeah.
With real momentum, they would just vanish. Okay, so let's go back to possibilities are endless. So what can we do? BCFW have shown what to do at the tree level. What about loop level? And the first thing that comes to mind is this very special class of one loop amplitudes, which are rational functions. So they're determined from their poles. If, let me just say this right now because I'm not going to say it later, you don't have to use this method only for rational amplitudes, it's just that this is simpler. If you have amplitudes which don't vanish at the tree level, so they're not rational functions, they'll have branch cuts, but then your contour is just going to hug very closely the cuts, and then again, you use it to determine the finite rational part of the one of amplitude. Okay, so Bernix and Kosover, they just follow the BCFW prescription, and they found interesting things. Namely, at the one-loop level, things don't seem to work like they do at the tree level. For instance, if you use the BCFW prescription for this class of one-loop amplitudes where all the gluons have the same helicity, so I cannot pick one with a positive and a negative helicity anymore, but nonetheless, I choose to do the BCFW prescription, then because they knew the result for these one-loop amplitudes, they found that there was a boundary integral. There is a boundary term coming from this contour integral at infinity. So then, knowing the answer, finding the problem, they are very clever and they found something else, a triple shift, which seemed to do the job. Namely, now you have three momenta that you're shifting. Your analytic continuation now is defined with respect to these three external momenta. And if you're clever, you find such a triple shift such that the boundary term doesn't appear anymore. Now, for this other class of rational amplitudes, where one gluon has opposite helicity from all the rest, the BCFW shift is good enough. There is no boundary term, but there is a double pole. And we can see it. We can understand it. And, well, what do we do with it? Bernix and Kosover, again, they're very, 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 very clever. They found the problem. They found the solution. The solution is there are some soft factors whose form they conjecture. They couldn't prove, but they explicitly check, I don't know, up to 11 points, 11 external gluons. They conjecture that the soft factors do the job. And their job is to uncover a simple pole underneath the double pole. And that's because just based on kinematical arguments, all the other poles are going to be simple. You understand the origin of the double pole. I'm going to explain where it comes from. So what else can you miss except a simple pole underneath the double pole? So their conjecture for these soft factors was supposed to extract precisely the simple pole underneath the double pole. But you see, everything is here. You know, you try, and you see it doesn't work. And if you're clever, you find a solution. But ideally, I prefer to have a systematic approach and know beforehand what I'm going to get, just in case I'm not clever enough to find, you know, the solution if I find a problem somewhere. So our systematic approach is, again, to use the space column gauge to select other analytic continuations. So if you don't have a gluon with a positive and a negative helicity, what do you do? Or if you have, like here, what other freedoms do you have to try to find an equation that these soft factors will solve, and then you determine them analytically instead of guessing their form. So in this case, I'm going to show that we can precisely find the right analytic continuation such that there is no boundary term. In this case, I'm going to show that we have a bit more freedom than performing a double shift. And using that freedom, and basically, we're going to impose the condition that the amplitude is gauge choice independent, it's eta independent, or Lorentz invariant, and then we can solve for the soft factors of Bernix and Kosover. That's the philosophy. And then now everything else is just how to. So if you want to decouple, you can decouple now because I think I gave my main message. Okay, for double shifts, the BCFW shift is guaranteed to work at the one loop level, namely, it's not going to generate a boundary term, provided that you make the shift, as we said before, with a positive and a negative helicity gluon. Now, the triple shifts, if you have external gluons where all of them have the same helicity, obviously you cannot make these choices because you're going to have undefined factors of 0/0. It's not the same type of zero in the numerator and the same type of zero that we've used to select only a certain class of vertices, but it's just something very ambiguous, and there is no way to go to the space column gauge with a gauge fixing vector that defined from external gluon momenta which have the same velocity. But there is no problem with that. For instance, for this class of amplitudes, again, we have all Lagrangian which stare at the vertices. We know that all external gluons have the same velocity. We're going to select one of them to be reference, and we're going to keep, so this is positive velocity, we're going to have half of our twister base defined. The other half is arbitrary. So plus remains arbitrary. But as I said, there is no problem. We can just look at the diagrams, and we're going to realize very, very soon that the only type of vertices that you can have is this cubic plus, plus, minus set of vertices. With these ones, that means that you can make this triple holomorphic type analytic continuation, because again, you see the type of momentum dependence in the vertices is even more restricted than before. You have only p and p minuses. P plus doesn't appear. Because of that, you can make this triple shift. And you're going to be fine. I'm going to show how that works in a concrete example. Now, for this minus plus plus amplitude, again, we're going to fix the space con gauge only halfway through, even though if we want to, we can fix it completely and do the BCFW double shift. But as I said, we want to avail ourselves to a little bit more freedom. So we're going to keep this guy minus arbitrary. We're going to fix the other half of the the twister basis by selecting this lone negative helicity gluon to define the two plus elements of the twister base, and we're going to keep minus arbitrary. And later on, of course, we can choose this minus to be 2 or n or anything else that we want. But if we keep minus arbitrary, as I said, we're going to find that, you know, the z shifts that we're solving for are going to depend on eta. They're going to depend on minus. Obviously, the physical amplitude is supposed to be Lorentz invariant. It's supposed to be eta independent or reference twister independent. So that's the one ingredient that will allow us to find analytically what the soft factors of Bern-Dixon and Kosover have to be. So that's the story. So again, here you can find a set of triple shifts that will not change the vertices and will not change the polarization factors, and you can roll on with that.
So no boundary term simply means that A goes up faster than goes like 1 over Z?
You have at least one propagator. And if the vertices don't change, externalize that, then you're safe, right? So for this class of rational amplitudes where all the gluons have the same helicity, as I said, we found a set of triple shifts which is guaranteed not to produce a boundary term. So it's not an a posteriori fact. You know the answer, you try something, it doesn't work. You know from the very beginning it will work. And this is how you get to write the on-shell factorization at one loop level. So one means one loop, zero means three level. And it works. A bit more fun, I think this is more abominations. Okay, so this minus and all the rest positive helicity amplitude. I've explained that you find a way to analytically continue the amplitude such that there is no boundary term. This is very easy, very straightforward. However, the problem here is that you have double poles. And let me show you where the double poles come from. So say that we have a 4-point. This is 1, negative helicity, 2, positive, 3, positive, 4, positive. Now, 1 is chosen to be reference. It can participate only in minus, minus, plus type of vertices. That's the only thing you can have. But here you have a one-loop vertex. This one-loop vertex, you can compute it, and we did the calculation, the space con gauge, again, just for fun, just to make sure that, you know, it's a new gauge. Do you know how to compute? So, yes, you can. And it turns out that this one loop vertex, where all the gluons, like here, this off-shell one and the on-shell ones have the same helicity, has a 1 over p3 plus p4 square in the denominator. So in that reducible diagram, you in fact have a double pole, one coming from the propagator and the other one coming from the one-loop vertex. So this is the source of the double poles. And if you write a recursion relation which just takes into account the double pole, you run into trouble because, well, it turns out that the Zi poles depend on that arbitrary twister that we left unfixed. And if you just add the contribution coming from these reducible diagrams with the triple shifts that I told you before, you find that the answer is going to be minus dependent. But this is something that you already understand what you're missing. If you just sum over reducible diagrams, what you're missing the irreducible diagram. And it turns out that the irreducible diagram is the source of the simple pole underneath the double pole. And as advertised, you can infer the existence of these extra terms just by adding what you'd have if you ignore the simple poles. So you can easily understand the factorization of that reducible diagram. It's harder to understand where the simple pole might come from because it's harder to understand how the reducible diagram somehow knows that it wants to, you know, some legs want to, it's something like some STI, I don't know. I don't have a good explanation for it, but it's the irreducible diagram which gives rise to these simple poles. And you can infer their existence, and you can solve for the soft factors. So let me show you how this works for the 4 point, and then I'm going to conclude. So this is the 4 point. There is an S channel pole, but there is a reducible, that's the reducible diagram there. And you have another 1 over S factor coming from the one-loop vertex. There is a U channel pole, and again, it's a reducible diagram, so you have an additional 1 over U factor. So you have these two terms. And the analytically continued amplitude will have singularities at the shifted kinematic invariants. You can solve for them. And if you just add these two reducible ones, then you find that the answer is going to be minus that arbitrary twister dependent. So then you come up with an ansatz of this sort, and then you solve for fs and fu, imposing reference twister independence for a of z. So that's all there is, and you can find a very nice and intriguing rewriting of this four-point, one-loop four-point, in terms of one-loop three-point, dressed by these functions. Anyway, it's interesting. And for the 5 point, I'm going to skip all the details and just show you something quite nice. So there are kinematic invariants. Besides this hidden simple pole underneath the double pole, everything else is well understood. And it's interesting enough that, so you see here, I've made the shifts 1, 2, and 5, that triple shift that I told you about, with keeping the minus twister arbitrary. So in this case, where you factor on a plus, 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 plus one loop, you don't get an addition, you don't get a double pole. You don't have anything like 1 over P12 in addition as you would have here. And it turns out that these guys, the ones which don't have anything like that, will be separately reference twister independent. So in fact, when you search for the guys which will give rise to soft factors, they have a very nice structure, and you think, oh, there are many, many terms that I have to sum. In fact, there are very few. And these are the guys that can be made reference twister independent by adding these soft factors, and then you solve for the soft factors. And you see they explicitly depend on minus. And for the 6 point, okay, there are many, many diagrams here, for instance. These guys add up to something, and these guys add up to something that's reference twister independent. Likewise, these guys add up to something that's reference twister independent. So in fact, when you solve for the soft factors, you will never have more than just a handful of terms that you have to solve for. And this is the expression for the soft factors for arbitrary n. So now, at this stage, for instance, if you specify minus to be, let's say, 2, then what we will do is, instead of making the triple shift, we make the double shift, the BCF double shift. So now, if you choose minus to be 2, then basically you're going to recover the soft factors of Bendixson and Kosover. So these guys, this guy, for instance, vanish. That guy will vanish, and then you just are left with two terms, one here and one here instead of four. And that's exactly what Bendixson and Kosover conjecture. But here is, well, you can solve for it. It's less of a conjecture than a proof. So for conclusions, I'm not going to test your patience anymore, so I'm just going to stop here.
What happens with other hallucinogens?
For the other ones, what you're going to do is you're going to take right poles at kinematical invariance, but then you have cuts coming from logs and polylogs. Your contour is going to hug whatever branch cuts you're going to have. And then the onshell recursion, so you determine the location of the cuts using unitarity, and then the finite part of the amplitude is determined through the use of onshell recursion, because that's what you're left with. So that's how you go. But you know, there were these subtleties that you encounter right away at one loop, and instead of you patch as you go, you can try to have something that's very systematic and avoid surprises later.
Systematic and loop number as well.
I'm not that bold. So that's it. Thank you for your attention.
That's a different direction.
Yes. With MHVs, what you do, you never have on-shell amplitudes. You have MHV vertices. You might think that's not a big difference in principle, but I still think that the on-shell recursion is a bit more powerful. And with MHVs, actually, there was a very interesting paper, which I don't know why it hasn't received a lot of attention, one by Paul Mansfield. So what he showed is that if you, again, start from the Lagrangian, he went to the light cone. Well, light cone, space cone, they're not really that different from each other, modulo the fact that the space cone engenders the sonority continuation discussion. So what Paul Mansfield did, he went to light cone. He again eliminated the unphysical degrees of freedom, and he stared at the vertices, the non-local ones that I had. And if you think about the helicities that you have in vertices, well, you have cubic vertices, plus, plus, minus, minus, plus, minus, and you have quartic vertices. Well, that's one arrangement, but you can have some another. So MHV is defined to be an amplitude or a vertex where two gluons have the same helicity and the others, whatever, the rest is the other option. So say that this two classes define an MHV. These two guys look like MHVs. This one does not. So what Mansfield did, he found a canonical transformation, basically some field redefinition, which got rid of this minus minus googly MHV. And then you trade this for an infinite set of plus, plus, and n minus vertices. So, you can derive MHVs from the Lagrangian approach again. So I think, you don't have to be too stubborn and stick with, S matrix is better, Lagrangian is not. But if you try to blend the two, then that's the best approach.
I thought Cacciato claims that you can always reconstruct any loop amplitude from these maximum
for the loop amplitude, at least one loop. I don't know about any loop, but for one loop.
He says he can do it for any loop.
Okay, more power to him. What can I say? Can he really do it for anything?
Well, he doesn't tell you, actually.
Any choice of helicities? I would love to see some explicit. Okay. Anyway, so for one loop, the statement is that this generalized unitarity will determine that. So you have this basis of boxes, triangles, and bubbles, and tadpoles, and any one loop amplitude can be decomposed in terms of these known integrals times the coefficient, and the coefficient is determined through the use of generalized unitarity. So you make more than one cut. That's the story, and it's a very powerful very powerful procedure. And there are some other things that, you know, you can be excited about this.
We were discussing the trees that sort of look like that, because of those the basis of blue balances that are used on phi cube, essentially, scale or amplitudes.
And
we were choosing a gauge to reduce it to a phi cube problem, and then using...
Well, if you have generalized unitarity, say you have this square, it's not really phi cube, because at each... You know, when you make these cuts, you at each
well,
of these,
I mean, yeah.
Right? It's phi cube. It's only for the basis of integrals, but then the coefficient is determined from sawing to get.
I
know you know, but. And anyway, even in that case, you still have the finite piece of the amplitude, and the finite piece is determined through this on-shell procedure. So again, you take the contour at infinity, the same trick. And Zwiebern and friends have written a wonderful program to implement this stuff. So it looks good. But there are some other benefits that I think you can get from the space cone gauge. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with something called Mandelstam-Lybrand prescription. If you do one loop amplitudes, you have to be careful about how you avoid the pulse that you get from 1/d the D pluses.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's 1/k0 plus k3 or minus k3 in the integrand. And the problem with this pulse is that as you do the Vick rotation, if you use Cauchy's principal value prescription, say it's just the principal value of the integral, so say that you have this k0 plus k3 minus I epsilon plus 1/k0 plus k3 plus I epsilon. This would be the principal value prescription for 1/1/2 for 1/k0 plus k3. This prescription doesn't work. It doesn't work because it interferes with the Vick rotation. You know, you have to have the poles in the...
It doesn't work with the Vick rotation, but,
And it doesn't work with the power counting, the naive power counting. It violates that.
On the other hand, sometimes it gives you the right answer. So in two-dimensional QCD,
the
principal value prescription, you know, it both has this lambda prescription.
Uh-huh.
Light cone gauge. So there are three prescriptions you can do. You can do a Hooft's one, which is singular. Then you can do the principal value one, which is kind of like and you get the right answer, confinement, area law for Wilson loops, the right answer to QCD
in two dimensions.
Two dimensions, where the singularity is worse. And then you can do Mandelstam-Lybrand, and you get the wrong answer.
Oh, really?
You get no confinement. What really happens remarkably there, I don't know about, is that in two-dimensional QCD, where the singularity is really severe and light cone gauge, doing the wrong thing that at Hooft and Callan and I did, principal value or, lambda goes to zero, just a cutoff, you pick up the effects of instant time, of non-perturbative, which are, magnetic monopoles with zero field strength distributed over the infinite time.
And to understand...
Which we showed by taking the sphere in the limit, where you can get rid of the instant time. So it's really a bizarre thing.
So the problem with
the fact that you're wrong,
and you still get something
that
right.
You actually pick up the stuff you can't see perturbatively.
Yeah, that I didn't know that. That's very interesting. Anyway, what I was going to say about this is that this principal value prescription, it interferes with the Vick rotation because the poles are in adjacent quadrant instead of being diagonal. So then Mandelstam and Lybrand gave prescription where basically you have something like k minus. Let me just use k plus and k minus. K plus, k minus, plus I epsilon. And then with this, you distribute the poles right. And the benefit from doing something like this is that the power counting works. And then you can do something like Mandelstam did.
By the way, this one is easy to do in position space. If you do it in position space, you'd automatically be doing this.
Yeah. And Mandelstam, when he showed the UV finiteness, that's the reason where I was gearing towards is this long introduction. You know, everybody asks, what about UV fineness of supergravity? What about UV fineness of this and that? So what is it that Mandelstam did in 83, I think? He used an on-shell superspace approach for n equal 4 superangular. So again, you go to the Lycon. You don't care anymore about auxiliary fields. So you just have the physical degrees of freedom. You know they're going to form the right multiplet, you know, equal number of boson and Fermi degrees of freedom. And he showed that that prescription doesn't interfere with power counting. So you have everything packaged in a superfield. If you look at the vertices, you do the naive power counting, and then you show that whatever you do at one loop is UV finite. So obviously something like this can be done in space con gauge. There is no problem. And the other thing I was going to say about space con gauge.
No.
He didn't talk. He talked n equal 4 superangulars. But you can do the same thing with supergravity. And I was thinking of actually looking at that.
That was just an argument for one loop.
Yes, but you know, the no triangle, whatever, hypothesis for the unbelievably good behavior of one loop. N equal 8 supergravity. So if you have this on-shell superfield formalism, together with the space congage and what Nima showed, he showed that, you know, I can have space congage for gravity. Again, it's not that different from Lycon. And with Lycon, it's obviously you can do Lycon for gravity. That's how you count the number of degrees of freedom. So if you package these two things together, maybe you have a shot of, again, a very hands-on understanding of why n equal 8 sugra is so magically good behaved in the UV. And again, what Zwiebern was saying is that these zeta shifts, these regions where you look in a certain region in the UV with these analytic continuations of the momenta are crucial to prove the no triangle hypothesis. So I think we have all the right tools. It's just, you know, energy and inspiration and and collaborators.
We need to prove n equals 8 is finite.
UV finite, yes. Just by you know, taking Mandelstam's approach, I don't see why it shouldn't work. An on-shell superspace approach allows you to have one field for everything. That's supersymmetry, the power of supersymmetry. Then you pick the right gauge, and then you look at the vertices. And if power counting works, and that's the other thing that I kept trying to say, with space con gauge, you don't need anything like Mandelstam-Lybrand. It's power counting, it just works, just because, you know, you have 1 over k, 1 plus ik2, that's the factor that you have in the denominators. And these guys don't interfere with the Vick rotation. And
if you do that for gravity, what do you get? Squares?
Well, the way I would do about it, that there. Okay, so what Nima did, he used the background field approach. The background field approach, he used it from my understanding because he wanted to look at the behavior of these analytically continued amplitude in the large Z limit. In the large Z limit, it's like you have one very fast moving particles through some background field. But if you don't want to do that, if you want to just look at the vertices the way I did, then I would start expanding around flat space and, you know, you get an infinite number of vertices. So what? You don't want to do Feynman diagrams. You just want to say, look, power counting works. These are the vertices. I know what.
Just that you get more and more powers of momentum.
Right, but if those powers are in the denominator and nothing comes with z in the numerator, that's again what the space congage would be. It's a shot. I don't claim I have the answer. Thanks. What I find fascinating is how all these things were already there. And yet, Witten had to come with his twister string theory, and people just jumped on MHVs, and they were trying to derive the MHV vertices, and they found this. And it kind of happened by happenstance when everything was already there.
That's the way everything develops.
Yeah, I know.